Jackson's Prancing Pony scenes, I must admit, because I love the courtyard scenes.
Popping of the hooves. With all the mist and stuff, and you've got that really deep...
it felt like a real medieval town.
Choir and things where it comes in just as these riders come in.
Because it's dark, it captures the dark flavour of that sort of environment anyway. Mm. And Peter Jackson's a bit too bright, and it's too well done, and it's overly real. Mm. But in the cartoon, you're actually drawn into that imaginative world, and it is dark and gloomy. Mm. But yeah, there's death just there on the edge.
Yeah, I think so anyway. Superb. Should we have a listen to the scene of the Balrog having a little a fight with Gandalf. The hairy wicked. That's a theme of the Balrog having a little tiff with Gandalf, what's his face, and falling into the big hole at the end of it all, obviously. You listen to Spit and Feathers, of course you are, and it is Phonic FM, if you're wondering what channel you're listening to on the radio. Lock that dial with superglue, don't go anywhere, okay? Just continue listening for the next 55 minutes and beyond. We've got DJ Mooney in at 12 o'clock, he'll be playing his super psytrance and deep progressive house. I think I got that right this time. DJ Mooney has actually emailed in and said, all this talk about spooky driving, I'm now setting off down a country lane to get into the studio. Tar. So he's...
the back seat.
DJ Mooney, look into your rearview mirror and watch out for any small movements. Shadows. Spiders. Demon's faces. Tony, you had a great question for our wonderful guest Ashley Thorpe here. Go for it. What have you got?
I've got loads of good questions for you. Just he keeps talking. One good question, which I want to ask is, if somebody came to you tomorrow, some big director representing one of the major studios, and they just dropped a budget in your lap and said, right, go ahead and make your film, which one would you make? Would you remake one of the ones you've done already, or would you embark on one of the new ones you got in pre-production?
Well, apart from finishing Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings.
Huzzah!
Hoorah! We didn't just feed on that line.
Hey! Spontaneous! I think I would do Spring Hill Jack, but I would probably develop it to being a feature, because the more that I try to write it, the more that I work on it, there's so much scope, because there's so many interesting overlapping things in the Victorian period that it seems to relate to. And you've got the things like previously to that, you had the London Monster that was attacking women about 50 years previous to Spring Hill Jack. Then you get Spring Hill Jack, and then 50 years after that, you get Jack the Ripper. Mm. And there's just so many sort of weird myths and things that it's drawn into, and you get the Mothman links with it, and there's just so much to talk about. And Jekyll and Hyde in there.
Well, Jekyll and Hyde was at the same time as Jack the Ripper.
Absolutely.
And at the same time when Spring Hill Jack appeared in Liverpool. Those sorts of comparisons there are pretty striking. I just find it very strange that the sort of first Spring Hill Jack appears, what, in 1836 in London?
Yeah.
To an 18-year-old girl. And again, we go back to these tales about not opening your door late at night and wandering out of your house, your safe environment.
Yeah.
It's really eerie. And not only that, but it's, you know, he's described as a gentleman in a cape, black cape. Until he reveals himself, not exposes himself, reveals himself, yeah.
Well, the other thing I found really fascinating, and it's definitely going to be worked into my telling of it, is that he was absolutely seen as a boogeyman at the time of the attacks. You know, real or not, some of them I'm not sure, some of them I have my doubts about, because a lot of conflicting evidence.
Mm.
But somebody was out there doing something. The thing which I find really curious is that when the Penny Dreadfuls got hold of this character, a short time after, you know, a lot of the early attacks, what they did to him was turned him into a kind of into a heroic character. And they said that he was originally a rich man who had been tricked out of his inheritance and that was now going to fight against the criminals that had wronged him and against crime in general by donning this bat-like cape, a helmet with horns, and pretty much a utility belt. Yeah, he had equipment.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was looking at it thinking, hang on a minute. The vigilante, but who looks like a villain. That's...
You got your anti-hero play there, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you've got to be careful, because you can't go, Bob Kane, nick that.
Yeah. Well, you know, no, but it's influences but upon
it's,
influences.
Yeah, it's influences, you know, upon influences, yeah. And it's an influence that I don't think people really talk about. I think they're also frightened that, you know, everyone's going to get sued. But I'd like to touch upon it because I think that it was the beginning of something, and it wasn't just Spring Hill Jack that the Penny Dreadfuls did that with. They did that with people like Dick Turpin.
That's right.
Dick Turpin was, you know, as much as I loved him in the TV show, he was probably a horrific character. If you go to York, they're in no doubt about what he was like. He'd shoot a kid and take his purse if he could do it. But the Penny Dreadfuls got hold of him and made him the gentleman of the road. And,
can I just ask about the Penny Dreadfuls, in case anybody doesn't know what they are? Can you kind of summarise?
Yeah, they were periodicals. They were stories usually lurid in subject matter. Kind of derivative in some ways from the execution chapbooks. Basically, when somebody like a highwayman used to be executed, they'd print up a memento, pretty much. They'd have almost like a storybook about their exploits and things, and you'd buy them by the side waiting for this guy to get hanged. They were a souvenir, you know, like a concert guide thing. And the Penny Dreadfuls kind of developed from that and realised that their audience wanted the slightly lurid, slightly bloodthirsty, and yet romantic things. They're still quite romantic, even though they were quite gothic and horrific. And they were sold for a penny, and they were printed on cheap stock and distributed quickly, and, you know, written very quickly as well.
Things that they're affordable and the precursor to comics.
Yeah.
And in the 19th century in particular, like Dick Turpin appears in 254 issues, and they have these serials week after week after week.
And things like Varney the Vampire that went on for, God, thousands. It's just, if you had them collected now, they'd be a little encyclopedia
Britannica.
They're
very rare, aren't they? I mean, there's very few copies that you can find. And the fact is, you know, people wanted them this badly. I mean, they were aimed at working class adolescents. And if you couldn't afford one, there'd be a gang of you who'd, you know, share the cost of it and share the read of it. Don't even get to keep it.
Yeah.
But it's a really big thing, because after 40 years of dominating what we call now the market, you'd have these other magazines starting up, some of them costing half a penny.
Yeah. And a lot of that was done through censorship codes as well, because there were a lot of letters at the time, just exactly the same thing that happened with horror comics in the 1950s in America, that there were a bunch of people, the Mary Whitehouses of the world, who did the same old thing as always and just said, well, you know, the crime's a bad problem at the moment. Well, you know what? I blame those penny dreadfuls myself. I don't blame poor living conditions and unemployment. I blame those penny dreadfuls. I blame those comics. That's what's leading these people astray. So they were quite shrewd about how they did it. They didn't just go, they're banned. Because if you do that, things go underground anyway. They brought out cheaper, more moralistic alternatives and swamped the market, like you say, with them. And it pretty much just killed them off. They couldn't compete.
Yeah, sounds awful.
But even some of those moralistic journals actually changed and became the sort of pulp fiction as we know them today.
Yeah.
You can't, just to sell more.
You can't suppress, you know.
No, good stories.
Sex and death.
No.
People love sex and death. Want.
No, so you can't suppress sex and death, you're absolutely right. Let's talk about that world of fog.
Why would
play.
You?
Okay, so that's Halloween, obviously, not the fog. What am I talking about? They've been pummeling me really hard with bats because I got that wrong. That's just a terrible faux pas. I'm really sorry, guys, okay? You can stop hitting me now. And I'm bleeding too, which is perfect for tonight's show. We've got Ashley Thorpe in the studio of Carrion Films, horror filmmaker extraordinaire, award winner, etc. We've got to keep plugging that, haven't we, really?
Totally.
He's laughing, but he's being modest. He is very, very good. And the films are incredible, so check him out on the website right now. Email in if you've got any questions for Ashley. Actually, we have got one or two, which I'll ask in a moment. But what I wanted to ask first was about Hellraiser. You've got a good connection with Hellraiser. Tell us all about it.
Yeah. I've always been a really big Clive Barker fan. Sort of used to buy his books from good old Read and Return on 4th Street.
Yeah.
I want a discount there now.
You've got to take it back.
Yeah. I take it back. And I was just always crazy about it. And then I was always very, very impressed by Doug Bradley. Because apart from the fact, obviously, the Pinhead character in Hellraiser is a great performance, and very restrained performance, actually, especially in the first one. They get a little bit more cartoonish as they go on, but I think that's the script's fault more than anything. But I've always liked him as an actor, and when we were actually given a much better budget for The Hairy Hands, I spoke to Tom Atkinson, my producer, and said, right, okay, this is going to sound really nuts, but as we're just starting off, why don't we list all the stuff that we really, really want? Not just write down stuff we know we can do. Why don't we start off with at ridiculous heights, and then we'll work our way back down to where we usually are. Right? Let's do that. Let's work at the top and then work down.
Yeah, that's a good way of doing it.
And I said that it sounds daft, but, you know, the previous films are getting good press, especially in the horror magazines and things. They seem to really like them because I think they can sense that they're sincere. They're not just made as an angle. Why don't we see if we can try and get somebody linked to the horror genre to be part of it? Any somebody with a great voice. And we came up with a list of different people, all of which were dead. we came up with a list, and I was really horrible, actually. I just said, right, Tom, I've got about 5 months of animating ahead of me, so can you go off and sort that out? And just left him to it.
So you wrote this ridiculously, this over-the-top list.
Yeah.
All these A-star
celebrities. Well, at one point, we had... because I met Don Boyd at Two Short Nights, and he's friends with John Hurt. So I... very cheekily said, is that right, you're friends with John Hurt? Can you ask him something? And he forwarded him an email from me. But he was busy doing a film in Australia, I think, at the time. So it wouldn't ever... I didn't get a reply. It's not like he said, you know, I'm very sorry. I didn't get anything.
Okay.
But then I said, right, well, Doug Bradley. Let's try and get Doug Bradley, because he's... not only has he got a great voice, but he's really sincerely... he really loves horror, and he loves the history of it. And he's very well versed in it.
He plays Pinhead, doesn't
he? Plays Pinhead in Hellraiser, and remarkably enough, it was really weird. I really should try and get Tom here one day to talk about how on earth he did it, but he managed to he tracked down Seraphim Films, which is Clive Barker's production company, contacted them. They put him in contact with Doug Bradley, but also put him in contact with two other of the characters who played Cenobites as well. I can't remember his name now, and also Nicholas Vince. And Doug Bradley, after a lot of sort of, not really umming and ahhing on his part, but after a long chase with Doug Bradley's agent, Doug Bradley just said, yeah, I'll do it. And it was a pittance, absolutely pittance. So we had to go up and I tried to arrange it around some editing I was doing in London, and we had to go along to a studio in Soho, and, you know, sat there with knees knocking and waiting on this very stormy day, very aptly, for Doug Bradley to walk in. And, you know, in he comes, and he just can't help but being slightly intimidated by him. He does come across like he does in the films, without the pins, obviously. But he's quite intimidating at first. But then, you know, he crack a few jokes and things, and after a while, we were just laughing and just talking about. God, it sounds so lovey now, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's the just, life you're entering, my friend.
Oh yeah, I hope so. You know, yes, get yourself soon. A cravat.
You wouldn't believe it, but I saw Peter O'Toole the other day.
Lovely.
He bent over and said, "Hey,
lovely.
Pick up that soap." Anyway, go.
Oh dear. No, he was a really nice bloke, really sincerely into it. The other thing that he said, which I was really, really proud of, was the fact that he thought what Karen Films were doing was a brilliant idea. That he had taken these neglected legends and things and making them these very individually rendered kind of short films. He thought that was fantastic. So that made my day.
I'm not surprised. And you got him for the full film, and how much kind of studio time was needed for him then?
Not very much, actually. I mean, he does narration as the voice of Ed Berry's character. He does his boss. So he's primarily at about the first third of it, but we we set up two mics, and we had Sam Burgess, who's one of my friend's wife, who had had some theatre experience, and she sat opposite him looking very intimidated and did a reading with him, and we did it a number of different ways, and then it was, like you say, it was all over actually quite quickly. So while we were chatting, I sat down with a marker pen and I wrote out some stuff for the trailer, and very sheepishly said, "Yeah, would you mind if I've written this, and could you read it for the trailer?" And he went, "Oh yeah, no problem." He said, "Anything? You don't want me to do it in a Devonshire accent, do you? Because it would be dreadful." and he did do one which I've got somewhere, which he tried, and it was hilarious. It was like the Wurzels or something. Doug Bradley does the Wurzels.
Now,
now an extract.
Is it contracted? are we allowed to play this at some point, or would that be really bad form?
Once I get the trailer sorted out, then yeah, I mean, you could play it as an audio piece, because Mick's doing the finishing touches now on. Getting the music sorted out on the trailer. Now it's going out to festivals, we can start publicising. And more than welcome, you'd be able to play it. And because it'll be sort of copyrighted. Great. UK Film Council.
What
and
about
whatever.
What about the Wurzels version? We like to
play it. The Wurzels version.
10 years.
Could do with some break beats on it. Could do with something.
Yeah, maybe it's a DVD extra in there.
Yeah. Truly horrifying Easter egg. Bad Easter egg.
Thank you.
Okay, you're going to need to explain that, Mr. Ashley Thorpe. That's a nice weird track for us at 25 past 11. You are listening to Phonic FM, by the way, in case you're wondering what's going on. It is Spitting Feathers, and we've got Ashley Thorpe in the studio, who is a filmmaker, award-winning filmmaker, a horror filmmaker as well. Tell us about that track, mate. It was different to the other ones, most definitely. Why?
You played it backwards. No. That's a piece of music called Film One by John Fox. Mm. Who was the original vocalist of Ultravox before the band got Ewered. Mm. And he was sort of one of these early electronica sort of pioneers, really. Gary Numan's stuff sort of lent more towards the sort of the punkier, more pop-inspired edge, was that John Fox was really interested in experimenting with textures and things.
Mm. Like Stockhausen.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's... He's interesting because he did do pop music, but it sounded like that. You know, even the ones with choruses had that really grating, dirty kind of mistuned radio kind of element to it. And the reason that that's on there, apart from me being a sadist, is that... and I like to scare the cats with it. Is that... There was a point when we were working out the soundtrack of Hairy Hands, and we kind of started getting a little bit stuck, I think, because we wanted the 60s elements and we also wanted this electronic element. But what we didn't want it to sound like was Hooked on Classics.
Hmm.
You know.
Easy to do.
Yeah, we just didn't want it to be strings and... Oh, no. Dreadful. So we're just trying to find some kind of textural quality to make it work. And I was... sat down one morning having breakfast listening to John Fox like you do, and that one came on, which is the B-side to a quite a big selling single called Underpass, and apart from the fact that the cat literally did shoot across the room in terror because I had it quite loud, I just suddenly looked out and thought, that's it, that is absolutely it, this is going to be the thing, because Mick loves this type of music as well. That's going to be the thing that's going to fire his imagination. And I just emailed it to him, and I just got an email back about half an hour later that just went, genius.
Yeah.
and that was it. He just took those ideas and took that kind of aggressive, I mean, it's weird, it's synthesized music, but apart from, you know, the drippy tap sort of drum beat to it, the rest of it doesn't sound like how synthesizers sound now.
No, well, they were all quite analogue then, weren't they? I mean,
everything's digital. And that's the kind of electronic sound I wanted. I wanted an early electronic sound. I didn't want it to sound like... I don't even know what you'd say now.
It's the Pet Shop Boys? Or?
Oh, yeah, that'd be genius. Erasure.
Yeah, could you do that for Spring Hill Jack? That'd be quite good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it might be interesting. I can make it a musical.
Actually, wow.
Neil Tennant is... Spring Hill Jack.
Have you got any ideas for the sort of music you want for Spring Hill Jack?
Yeah. Well, we've had a few. I was speaking to Mick about Spring Hill Jack before Hairy Hands, because originally that was going to be the one we were going to do next. But I'd like it to be quite classical. But at the same time, do you remember that? That program from the 70s called Picture Box.
Yes.
And that very eerie, very kind of Victorian music box at the beginning. I want it to have that kind of thing about it, because I want it to have this eerie, almost like a childhood thing about it, because it is about some creature that's preying on innocence. So I'd quite like it to be very dark and tonally dark, but at the same time I'd like the theme to incorporate that sort of music box quality.
So maybe we should call up Michael Nyman or maybe Philip Glass or somebody like that could do it. Oh, they did. Which one did the Candyman?
Yeah, Philip Glass, wasn't it?
Philip Glass did that, yeah. Is that the kind of area you're thinking, that kind of creepy...
Sort of. I mean, I'd probably sit there and I'd have to get my ham and eggs kit together for Mick and just go, I want a bit of that and a bit of that, you know, somewhere in between. And then, as usual, we hit the nail on the head and come out with something spot on. But something, the other thing that I was listening to when I started writing the script, actually, was the theme to, not that it's the one next, but the theme to Vertigo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because that's got something which is very playful and very dreamlike about it, but then it has these very harsh strings that come in.
Hmm.
And I want to try and get something that speaks of the kind of Jekyll and Hyde nature of the character and have that very evocative in the music as well.
Tony, you were going to ask a question then. It looked like your eyes were asking a question.
I didn't want to destroy the sort of, you know, movements of
waffling.
Yeah,
the waffle.
No, it wasn't. I mean, you're not just doing films. I mean, you actually were sort of embarking on writing a novel.
Yeah.
And this is something called Junction. And it's funny because on your website, you mentioned, I mean, this is a fantastic sounding idea for a novel. It really captured me. But I just noticed that there's a quote underneath, which I'd like it to sort of link it to this novel idea called Junction. If you want reassurance, look to religion or science. Art is meant to disturb. Art is transgressive. Discuss. But, you know, Junction sort of does play with this very dark world of the artist, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was quite a long time ago that I started that book. I started it when I was up in... it started off at university, actually, about 10 years ago. It was going to be I was going to enter an Orange script writing thing. And as soon as I started writing, I thought, my God, they're never going to go for this. This is crackers. So I just started developing the ideas into this novel that was just kind of an on and off project that went on for years. And I suppose it helped. I was working a lot with Mick, and Mick has a similar idea that art should be about questioning things. It shouldn't be just about the status quo. It's I can't remember who said it, that, you know, it's art's not a mirror to reflect the world, it's a hammer with which to shape it. It should be about taking something which doesn't look quite right and making something out of it so that people notice that it's not right. Change people's opinions about things, change things by, you know, doing things in a different way. And Junction was very much like a very, very dark, horrific fairy tale about that, as if that there were these group of people that had always kind of haunted the centuries, that just lived behind works of art. And the reason that they lived behind them was because they were constantly in hiding, that they were basically a race of being persecuted, and that God was just despised any type of change. And that this is where I get set fire to when I leave the studio and chased down stoned. The street, yeah. Stoned to death.
Yeah, go on, try it.
And it was just this idea about the control and the people who just want to kind of disrupt it. And one of the things that I liked about the idea is that I had this, and it was one of the germinating ideas about it, was that I had this idea about the Great Fire of London. And I always found it really fascinating that it happened in 1666 and with the plagues and everything. And then I don't know why, but I had this image of a painter sat on the night of the fire, before the fire had actually started, and doing a painting in real intense, sat there in the gloom by candlelight painting, but there being this very dark, angelic kind of character behind them. In the story, it's this character called Mecca, who dresses herself in a suit made from the tattoos that she takes from her dedicated followers and things, and she just kind of lives behind the worlds and things. But I just had this idea that she was there guiding this man's hand so that she could betray her employer of sorts. She would betray God by helping this man paint a portrait of him. So this man would paint a portrait of God, and as soon as the last brushstroke was done, that was enough, and that's why the Great Fire of London started, because it was God's rage. And from that point on, because this character and her tribe had just said, we're sick of it, there are worlds beyond worlds, and you're not letting anybody see any of these worlds. You're saying that if you look to the imagination and its power, then they're possessed or they're evil, and you'll be damned for it. And she just has the nerve to just stand up and say, I'd rather spend a lifetime in persecution, but at least know that I've tried to represent the truth. And then it all stems from that. And there are all sorts of things in there. I mean, the reason it took me so long to try and work on it was because I had so many ideas incorporating so many different things. I never finished it. I'd probably go back to it at some point.
Would you transform it from the idea of having it as a novel to a script for film or maybe animation?
I'd like to. It would be the kind of thing that I wouldn't have the guts to try and make myself, because it was too... Yeah, it was strange, because even though it was very, very personal, I wouldn't have the guts to try and make it, because it's just vast. It's absolutely vast. The scope of it is ridiculous. And there's one bit where this little boy, Arthur Millwood, when he's a little boy, he gets taken to an art gallery by his father. And his father's quite a domineering, kind of aggressive character. He's kind of dragging him through the crowd, like, you know, don't know why you want to go to a Ponzi gallery anyway, type of attitude. And Arthur's in there looking around. And the narrative threads have been leading up to this point where one of these other acolytes of this goddess have been racing away from the persecutors and has driven through a stretch of graffiti that they've painted, knowing that that graffiti will lead to another painting, but they just don't know which one. And she comes out through a great big painting in something like the Tate. So at the art exhibition, this little boy's standing there, and there's all these crowds everywhere, and this car comes rocketing out of the painting and just causes bloodbath. And this little boy's there looking as this driver, this freakish angelic driver, flops out of the seat. And yeah, it kind of goes on like that, you know. That's it goes fair. On. And
you know, to be honest, there's nothing that CGI can't sort out.
Well, yeah, that's it, but not my CGI. My CGI can't do that. But I mean, I don't know. Who knows? It could be one of those sort of pet project type of things that I could come back to. Or failing that, it would be interesting to develop it as this kind of big budget thing and give it to somebody.
A lot of writers do sort of go back to the early stories, and I've got an archive of early stuff that I'll go back to. And, you know, give it 10 years, you might have moved on and progressed. And
I've already been tempted to cotton pick from it occasionally, you know, and just
exactly.
I like the beginning of that. The beginning with the old woman that's bringing up bits of bone, realizes it's not hers and stuff. And
yeah,
we won't go into that.
No. Don't give away too much, because
I won't.
I've got a few questions from listeners, actually. One from Jenna here. She says, do you find the film changes in the edit dramatically, or do you have a solid vision as to how it will turn out in the beginning? We touched on this earlier about the way you create them, I suppose. But the edit is an important part.
The edit is quite an important part. I think that the one that changed the most in the edit... I tend to storyboard them pretty much from beginning to end, although the one which did change a lot in the editing was Screaming Skull, actually, because as I was putting it together, I realised that I really needed another section in it. I needed about another couple of minutes of animation for it to flow the way that I wanted it to work. So I actually went off and started animating some more stuff to fill in the gap in the middle, which wasn't storyboarded or scripted at all. I just suddenly ran off. It was the sequence in the trenches. I kind of wanted to have it, but I didn't storyboard it. I didn't really think about it.
So are you a less improvisational person, do you think?
I don't tend to improvise that much.
No. I mean, does that mean...
I do on set.
I was just thinking about comics, reading comics, because you storyboard really well. You're an artist. Did you read comics as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. 2000 AD, when I was a kid.
Yeah, the best.
Yeah.
So seeing the stories laid out like that, you can visualise a film pretty much from beginning to end, how it's going to look, sound, feel, possibly.
Yeah.
You can do that.
But you will also always find, as you're putting it together and you're watching the bits back, you always find gaps in the pacing. That happened also with the chase sequence at the end of Scarecrow, because I purposely left that sequence because I wanted it to be the big finale, the exciting bit. I left that to the end because I was kind of teaching myself how to animate as I was going along, and I was terrified. I thought, if this chase is rubbish, how naff is that? It's going to be awful. We're leading up to a chase and it ends up being rubbish. Yeah. So what I did is that I started editing the chase together, and then I actually did start improvising certain shots and just trying to make it more exciting, and thinking, okay, after you see the innkeeper in the carriage, it should suddenly cut to crow's doing this or something, and then it should go back to the scarecrow. I haven't done that. I've got to animate another bit. So the edit did actually tell me that this sequence is lacking.
Yeah.
Or with some of the films, like with Hairy Hands, actually, we actually quite ruthlessly cut down quite a lot of it, which is quite rare. I tried to make sure that I don't animate anything I don't need to, just because it's so time-consuming. But Hairy Hands really benefited from having a good hacking.
Did you at the end? Did you get somebody else to do that, or could you?
I did. Yeah, I generally tend to do the bulk of the editing myself. Hairy Hands. It's Mick Grierson helped me out edit the first half of Scarecrow, and I edited the chase myself. Literally, because it was an organic thing. It's just like that's too slow. That's too quick. And chucked in shots when I need them.
Do you allow your actors to kind of chip in, or do you pretty much say...
They just do as they're told. I actually enjoy working with actors, because I spend most of my life alone.
With your actors, though, it's interesting, because you're not really getting live action from them, are you?
It's a lot harder than it looks, actually. Ed Berry... He was in Scarecrow as the fop, and he takes the lead as in Screaming Skull and Hairy Hands. And it's actually, I'm amazed at how well he does it, because it is actually a very difficult thing to do. It's difficult enough to act in a makeshift kind of environment, because obviously, I actually don't really like the whole Phantom Menace way of making films where everything's green screen. And yet, ironically, that's pretty much exactly what my poor actors have to do. It might not always look like that, but that's exactly what they have to do. I've got to paint the background, so you're going to have to wait for it, you know. The only difference is with Hairy Hands is that we actually had a car and took the windscreen out and mucked about with the doors and things, so that at least Ed, instead of sat on a chair against a screen, he was at least sat in a car against a green screen. So he had mirrors and things to really look at, and he always comes up with really interesting ideas about different things that he would do and different things that he wouldn't do. He's very imaginative, and the thing that I was most impressed about is the fact that he underplays it, because it's very easy to overplay something if you're acting it in live action. But if you're doing it in animation, frame at a time, if you're not careful, you do look like Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah.
Because the facial expressions have to be very subtle, or else you do end up... You look like you're gurning and having an epileptic fit at the same time.
Because you would imagine, if you're taking, like, Polaroid snaps of a film, for instance... You'd get certain expressions which you'd be going, what on earth is he thinking or doing or saying there?
But I think Ed conveys emotions very, very well in it. And it is a difficult thing to do.
There are a couple of films that have been out, I can't remember what they called them, that was just literally photo snaps. Okay, I'm wasting my time. You obviously don't know what I'm talking about. But that must have been very time-consuming, just using Polaroids all the way through the film. I think it's Polaroids. But and it conveyed a love scene and all this sort of thing. I think I would find that virtually impossible to do. So I don't understand how you can direct a film like that, I must admit. I'd have to do either live action or fluid movement. But I'm in awe, really, of how you can get the expressions in the right place or the right time
It's a really odd, actually, because I'm sure sometimes Ed really hates me.
Yeah.
Because
he gave me a call earlier and said he does.
Yeah, I know. He's waiting for me outside, I'm sure of it. But I'm basically using Ed. No, full stop. I'm using him pretty much as a claymation model, really, I want him to move one frame at a time, and that gesture has to be a greater distance for the arm between there and there. You've got to make greater gestures if it wants to be fast, and tinier ones if it's going to be a slow movement. And he's got so used to doing it now that I just tell him what he's supposed to do in this shot, and then he does it. And then I film it and take the relevant frames at the relevant points. He's got so used to doing it now, I barely have to direct him, which is amazing. Whereas at first, people are very nervous, because it's a very difficult type of acting to get your head around. It's like, what on earth am I doing? Am I acting? Am I just posing? Yeah. I mean, are you going to come over and move my mouth open? I mean, what do you want me to do anything?
Yeah.
But I do need them to do something. They've got to act, but they've got to do it almost in slow motion. Mm. And then when I see what I want, I take the pictures almost just like a photographer.
Yeah, and you're right about it could make them look very cartoonish. I mean, when you look,
it can look ridiculous very easily.
When you look at Jan Svankmajer's film, Czechoslovakian Animator, who uses live action as well, and live people a lot of the time, in very surreal situations, or normal situations rather, with surreal things going on. You know, for instance, somebody will eat their trousers and his whole jaw will come away like a claymation and then close again. But it's a human sitting there, and his expressions are really over the top. And
they're very exaggerated, because that technique lends itself to the grotesque, I think.
Definitely.
And it's very difficult to do subtlety.
Yeah, which...
Unless you're Ed Berry. I'm going to get a pint out of him at the weekend.
Yeah, you're
doing
very well here. Yeah, he's... Listen to music and just laugh a bit. Ah, Gary Numan. That's just talking about that track, actually, very odd that I had it poised in my hand earlier to bring in to play to you, Ashley, because it's all about filming and acting. And then I thought, no, it's not eerie enough. It's not kind of scary and horror based. And there you are, bringing it in, the very same track that I thought.
You see,
strange. So why that track?
I'm a massive fan of that particular period in music, sort of late 70s punk through early electronic stuff. I love stuff like the early Adamant records, Susan the Banshees, anything like that, absolutely crazy about. But the Gary Numan stuff I particularly picked tonight, apart from the fact it's a cracking track off a great album, go and buy it now. Do yourself a favour. I was listening to lots of Gary Numan because, as well as the eerie early one, the John Fox thing, to come up with a textual ideas for the soundtrack for Hairy Hands, and just to try and incorporate electronica without it sounding poppy. And that was
and kind scary of my, as well,
and scary and ominous, hard. Yeah, and just trying to, and that was kind of the mission brief to Mick.
Because, I mean, you know, the electronic music can easily sound paranoic. Is that a word? You know, I feel paranoid when you listen to it. Ooh, somebody's looking at me. Oh,
it's cold. I mean,
it's the CCTV.
I mean, the weird thing is, I listen to most of the tracks on the album, and I find it really quite funky now.
Yeah?
I really enjoy it.
You're not right, really, are you?
No. I'm an android. But I think that originally, a lot of these people... I mean, even Bowie got bashing when he brought out Low, because it was very electronic.
I like that album. I think it's one of his best.
Yes, it's my favourite Bowie one. But people hated it because they said it was inhuman music and...
Yeah.
And, you know, they were...
Idiots.
..hateful with people like Gary Numan because they just thought it was horrible old stuff because it didn't seem human. But you listen to it now and you think it sounds absolutely human.
Yeah.
Well, it just sounds like people in an industrial environment.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean that they're robots.
But we are.
Oh, we are, yeah. We are.
I'm getting lost now.
Well, we are.
I'm going to play it.
I was thinking, if you want scary electronica, if you want scary electronica, play Tangerine Dream and that. You know, the Warsaw concert is very...
Well, they got roped into doing things like the soundtrack for Near Dark, didn't they?
Yeah.
And Sorcerer as well, if I remember that.
Sorcerer, yeah.
Years and years ago.
But Near Dark was more poppyish.
Ironically, yeah. That's the weird thing, isn't
totally.
It? We'll get Tangerine Dream because they do scary music.
Yeah.
What do you think? You could make it a bit poppier, could you?
Yeah. Make it happier. Oh, vampires. Yeah. Make it happier.
You can put some drums on it.
Yeah. That's a great 80s film, isn't it? Or whatever you call it. It's, hang on, I've got to say something before we leave. I've just looked at the time. It says 5 to 12. I've panicked. I've got a panic attack now. I've got to squeeze in 1,000 things in 5 minutes, and I'm talking about rubbish. It says here, have you approached the BBC Channel 4 with a view to making bigger budget films? This is the last question of the night.
Not directly. Although my producer, Tom, is... producer Tom sounds like a show in itself, doesn't it? Comedy Adventures of a Producer... He has worked with the BBC and people like Channel 4 before. So we're hoping that with things like the Hairy Hands, we might either get a screening on TV or potentially try to get some more industry interest.
Film 4 would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Absolutely. And if I can get the scripts of Spring Hill Jack complete soon, and with things like Hell Tour, there'd be something to try and sell them.
Is it worth pitching it at people like De Toro and Tim Burton, saying, "Look, I can do this, but would you mind funding me with this?" leave me to
send him a birthday card with a little note hidden in it.
Yeah,
by the way, you haven't got like 50 grand free.
Find out what the name of his auntie is, right, and just put
working that way.
Yeah, put on the B side, return to sender, Auntie Val. Or whatever it is, and then inside you trick him with a DVD and a picture of yourself going, play it, it'd be great. That'll work, wouldn't it?
No? That's kind of the way that I'm working at it at the moment.
I thought so. Yeah. Listen, Ashley Thorpe of Carrion Films, thank you very much for coming in.
My
Tony,
pleasure.
Co-presenter, thank you very much for chipping in.
Pleasure.
We can play your last track of the night. What is it?
I can't remember. I think it might be Suspiria.
Yes.
Oh, of course it is. Yeah, let's play that. It'll get faded out anyway because DJ Mooney's in and he doesn't like this kind of music. It freaks him out. Cheerio. It is, in fact, Susie and the Banshees. Never mind. Bye.
Grab your portable radio and thumb across the channels.